I feel like we live in this fascinating age where there's a confluence of cultures that creates enormous and interesting opportunities, and almost right alongside these enormous and interesting challenges. And I've been following this story about these Canadians, these three young Canadian men from London, Ontario, who, two of whom have been identified as casualties from this terrorist attack on this Algerian gas plant in mid-January. And listening to the Canadian media grapple with what these events signify, what the presence of young Canadian men acting as terrorists in Africa means. And one of the things that's gotten my attention about this story has been listening to the media tiptoe around it. It's really fascinating. There's great care being taken in both reporting the facts of the story, which of course remains our sort of much vaunted self-definition of journalism, right? Just the facts, ma'am. This objectivity, right? And this has been great care taken to say these are the facts, and at the same time to not infer that a particular set of the facts are the things that will help us understand the terrible nature of the story. And the tricky bit is Islam. The tricky bit in the Western media is the fact that these young men from Canada didn't grow up in that culture and religion, but converted to it, left the country to pursue that conversion, became radicalized as terrorists, and acted that out. Two of the three, at any rate. The third is in jail and was on the radio this morning complaining about the conditions and asking could he please be brought back to Canada to serve the balance of his sentence here where the food was decent. Which could sound like a judgment. I have no idea about the facts of why he's in prison, so there's the report. I personally, as a Canadian, I appreciate the sensitivity that drives this little tiptoeing act in our culture. I like the freedom of religion. I like that I am a citizen of a country where I can choose to believe what I believe and live deeply into that. And I want other people to enjoy that same freedom. And if suggesting or implying that it's conversion to a certain religion that equals radicalization to terrorism assails that freedom, then I think tiptoeing might be a reasonable option. I like what it represents in that regard. But there's this word, and I've used it a couple times already this morning, there's this word that in the process of the media trying to figure out how do we tell this story and not mistell this story, there's this word that has kind of gotten subbed in to the conversation, and it's kind of become this catch-all, and it's a really interesting thing. The word is radicalized, and the word is getting used by the media as kind of this neutral zone in dealing with the story, kind of a way to tiptoe through the minefield of both being an embracing culture and yet wanting to somehow represent the salient facts of the story. Or maybe the titillating facts of the story, hey? That too. So this word radicalized, it's kind of a curious word. It's a verbified word. It's kind of like what we've kind of done with this word, a little bit like what we've done with Google. You know, started out as a noun and turned into a verb. A little older than that, Merriam-Webster says the first known use of the word in that form is like early 1800s somewhere, but what does it mean? What does the word radicalized mean? We're going to probe all of this from the vantage point of the question that was in this week's email blurb. And if you don't get the weekly emails, can I just suggest, it is weekly. You don't get snowed under. And it is the way that this community sort of says, here's what's going on week by week. And so what Jason said earlier, that's just a little reminder. Do talk to Megan or one of the people that you kind of recognize as a regular part of the community and say, here's my information, and we'll get you on that list. As I said in that email, I want to probe the question of, can there be such a thing as good, radical, religious belief? So I want to start with our culture's idea of the problem, which is represented in the last few weeks by this word, I think, radicalized. So here's a definition for you. Radicalize, a transitive verb, for those of you that care about parsing our verbs more finely. The definition offered by Merriam-Webster's online dictionary, my go-to online dictionary, is to make radical. Especially in politics. I hate when they do that. All right, so let's carry on then. If it means to make radical, then what does radical mean? Here you go. Radical means a whole whack load of things, including things about vegetables, tubers, things growing from the base of a stem, and so on. Definition 3 is the one we're interested in. So, to make it a little easier to read, that looks like this. To be radical is to be very different from the usual or traditional, to be extreme, or favoring extreme changes in existing views, habits, conditions, or institutions, associated with political views, practices, and policies of extreme change, advocating extreme measures to retain or restore a political state of affairs, as in the radical right. So this is getting a little more interesting, I think. It's curious how becoming radical is understood to be kind of a catchphrase for something problematic, sort of like synonymous with the extreme part of the definition, right? Most of us, I think, probably, generally wouldn't care to be identified as usual or traditional, but those are the antitheticals here, right? So if somebody's speaking of a person and you say, well, what kind of person are they? Well, you know, they're kind of usual. Well, most of us just wouldn't feel that affectionate about that description of us. You know, we'd like to be a little more unique than that. But these are the poles of this definition. It's interesting that although we might not care to be described as usual or traditional, we probably don't have a lot of affection for the idea of being described as the opposite either, as an extremist. Why is that? Well, maybe part of the answer to that is inside the piece of the definition that talks about being a radical, meaning being associated with practices of extreme change, or maybe the one that talks about advocating extreme measures. Maybe that's the part we don't like. We are, as I said in the email, as Canadians, nice. And this feels like it assails that, threatens it, perhaps. But have you ever wondered, around this piece of language, have you ever wondered why this particular set of words and ideas doesn't tend to show up, at least in the media, around people doing things that are extremely good? Isn't that interesting? And maybe I'm missing something, but what immediately came to mind was a story from a few months ago in the kind of deep of winter, which we are still enjoying, but in the deeper deep of winter, about the bus driver who gave his shoes to the street guy. Remember that story? I don't remember anybody in the reporting of that story asking who radicalized that guy. I just don't remember hearing that thread anywhere in there. Why would an ordinary, nice, by our definition, usual guy go to such extremes? What happened to him? I want to know who turned that guy. I want to know who radicalized that guy. Because if it could happen to a bus driver, it could happen to my kid. If it happened to an ordinary working class Canadian guy, it could happen to me if the circumstances were right. So how come nobody's concerned about who radicalized the bus driver? Because by definition, as we have it here, that's what happened.
Good question.
I thought so.
Hey? They didn't use that term for the new pope either.
No, they didn't. Well, they're kind of starting to try to find language for the new pope. It's interesting, isn't it? I love that story, man. You know, total thank you for taking me on a tangent, Sarah. Okay, another week. Why does the whole world hope that the church will reform? Think about that. Okay. Because they do, apparently. All right, how does back to what we were talking about. How does radicalization happen? And who's vulnerable to it? If it could happen to a bus driver, if it could happen to a bunch of high school buddies from London, Ontario. Well, that's kind of kept the media busy talking to experts this past couple of weeks. And some of what's come out has been really interesting, I think. I want to give you a couple of those bits about how radicalization happens according to the experts and who's vulnerable to it. So this is from, because I'm a CBC news goer, if I go anywhere, that's where I go. This is from those sources. A guy named Roy Boisvert, former assistant director of CSIS. I can't even say the word CSIS without hearing Bruce Coburn in my head. CSIS, won't you tell me what you got on me at the end of the song anyway. So this guy, former assistant director of CSIS, told CBC News, quote, that radicalization of young Canadians is not uncommon. Quote, that felt like a bad lead to this quote. By the way, here's the quote. This is not about Canadians or a particular group, Boisvert said. It's about vulnerable youth falling prey to a nasty subset. Now listen, because I think he's onto something here. Falling prey to a nasty subset of religious ideology driven through Al-Qaeda narrative, being driven by a sense of adventure, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in their life, or perhaps following someone of influence in their life that will lead them to a path of violence. That's interesting. That's interesting. That's who's vulnerable. Clark Richard McCulley is a social psychologist professor at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania. Makes the observation that it's often a major life change that triggers an individual's need to make new connections and that can make them susceptible to radicalization. These guys are, this guy's an academic, and you can hear the care in his quote. He says, by losing everyday contacts and connections and even love that anchor most of us into our everyday lives, an individual can arrive at a point where they are almost a blank slate and wish to receive new ideas and let in new people. He goes on to say, that break in connections does not produce, here's the careful part, that break in connections does not produce political radicalization, but it produces an opportunity for major social change in many different possible directions. He goes on to say that it's just an accident who the individual bumps into at that point in their life. So if this person had run into a cult, he might have joined that, or if he'd run into some kind of organization to help wayward youth, he might have thrown himself into that. The point is that this sudden break in his everyday connections leaves him available for new connections, and with new connections come new ideas and new behavior. That's interesting stuff, eh? I want to take some of those ideas about radicalization, and I want to lay them alongside a biblical narrative of someone being turned, being radicalized, as our media would use that language. And the story is a story of Peter. It's a relatively familiar story. I'd never read it from this vantage point before, and I was, man, 7:30 this morning, having started considerably before that, I was kind of going, there's no way I'm going to fit this in, because the story just explodes in terms of renewed perspective for me when I read it this way. It was incredible. Anyway, Peter. So Peter has his whole life. We don't know a lot about it, right? We kind of meet him as an adult in a lot of ways in our narrative. But he has his whole life, and he has his whole own narrative of how the world works or doesn't work. He has his whole own community. He has his whole own career. He's built a business. He has business partners that are also family. We know this much about him. And it's a pretty middle-of-the-road kind of occupation. He's making a living. As a fisherman, which in his culture would have kind of put him somewhere in the middle. He's a fisherman, he's a businessman, he's a colleague, he's a family member, he's a Jew. And all of those things form the narrative that he has and that he operates from to give his life meaning and purpose and focus. And he steps away from a great deal of that to follow this crazy rabbi who comes walking down the beach, as Matthew tells the story, and says, I want you to come follow me. And as Matthew would have it, Peter and his brother put down their nets and follow Jesus. Yeah, I know I've got a company. I know I've got a business. I know I have clients. I know the boat's full of fish. And then if it is full of fish, that's like half a year's wages. But I'm out of here. So, think about that moment in the story in terms of the definitions that we just read about who's vulnerable to radicalization. This is interesting. Peter, as Matthew tells the story of Jesus calling him, is pretty much a textbook case of vulnerability for radicalization. I think this is important because what's going to happen as we go through the story is we're going to watch Peter go through a process of radicalization in which he makes a whole bunch of new connections, in which he encounters a whole bunch of new ideas, and they change his behavior a lot. And he ends up in what might seem, given his apparent vulnerability and openness to change, he ends up in a really unusual place. So I want us to kind of keep that grid going a little bit if we can. It's important to pay attention as well to who mentors Peter in this process, who it is that does the turning, and how that person's narrative, the turner's narrative, is different from the one Peter already has running in his head and in his life as a Jewish person. Because like any good Jew, Peter knew that he was part of a people group who, from the inception of that group, had been basically looking for a Messiah. They had been waiting for somebody who was going to come and fix what was busted. And what was busted for them as a people group tended to take the shape of military oppression. It tended to take the shape of them being embattled and on the losing side of the narrative in terms of power. And that's the situation Peter lives in. He lives in military occupation. He lives under an oppressive regime. And the narrative that is running in his head, just because he's Jewish, is one that says when the Messiah comes, when whoever this person is that comes, that our story says is coming, they're going to deal with this oppression. The oppression, remember, is military. The oppression might have ideological aspects to it. Of course it does. But the shape that it takes in everyday life is the shape of force. The shape of violence. The shape of an externalization of might that is overt and aggressive and oppressive. And that's the story that he's living out of. Because it's the story he grew up in. He's been steeped in it. It's interesting that it's also a narrative that's deeply integrated in his religious belief. This is not just, and I use the word advisedly, this is not just a social narrative. This is also a divine, if you will, narrative. And in addition to that narrative, when we think about who Peter is and his vulnerability to radicalization, we've got his personality here. To describe Peter as an early adopter would be putting it mildly. Okay? He is impetuous to a fault. He is for sure oriented to action. And personalities that are oriented to action, the experts tell us once again, are uniquely vulnerable to radicalization. And that's Peter. If I was a recruiter looking for someone that would make a good terrorist, I would pick Peter. He's ready. He's primed. And so when someone comes along in Peter's life and claims to be the Messiah, he drops his whole life and follows him. He leaves London, Ontario, and goes to Africa. Right? He just jumps cultural ship. He doesn't leave the country physically, but that's the magnitude of what's going on here. When he puts down his nets, when he walks away from his business, his livelihood, takes his sibling with him, that's one way to understand the shape of this story. We don't know a lot about Peter's family story, but I do not find it all that hard to imagine a family conversation about this. And I don't find it all that hard to imagine that it wouldn't have been a positive evening together. I imagine it might have been more like, what the hell were you thinking, man? Like, are you completely out of your gourd? You got a good job. You've got enough money to live. You got time invested in this. You've already got religion. You've already got a story. Now, what's with dropping all of that to follow this nut bar who walked down the beach and said, I'm the Messiah. Come with me. That's crazy. That's dangerous. That's extreme. You could get radicalized. And then, as if that's not weird enough, Jesus renames him. Anybody here know anything about cults? Okay. This is such a cultic thing to do. He changes his name, right? First he gives him a nickname, and then he gives him a new surname. Because he's Simon Peter, and he becomes Peter. And his name means rock. And Jesus says to him from early in the narrative, you know what, you're special. You're special. I'm going to build the church on you. Is anybody else hair standing up on the back of their neck? I mean, like, you see the shape of this story? You see the danger in this story? It's crazy. Think for a moment about Jesus as Middle Eastern. Not so hard, because he was. Despite all the airbrushed pictures to the contrary. I'm talking to somebody who's this the Bible series that's on TV. Was this somebody from here who said that Jesus on there looks more like Jesus than Jesus? Someone from this community, I can't remember who the conversation was with. And I'm like, you mean his eyes were bluer? Like, what does that mean? Anyway, think about Jesus as Middle Eastern. He was. Think about him as radical. Arguably the case. Now think about him as a recruiter for a budding terrorist cell. There's something about this guy, Jesus, that is so compelling that he can walk down the beach and call people away from their work and their careers and their life, and they come. And he can say to them, I'm going to give you a new name to signify your new place in the world, your new story, your new way of finding meaning, and they just accept the name. Wow. When they come to Jesus, he redefines them, doesn't he? Our name is a huge part of our identity, and that's why this is such a classic cult thing to do. It's a way of saying you have a new family now, you have new loyalties, you have a new story through which you view the world. It's a setup for radicalization. So, this is who Peter, in his vulnerability, has signed on with. And how this goes is going to have a lot to do with the narrative that Jesus is going to speak into Peter's life, because Peter is primed for action. So let's see how this goes. That's a lot of setup, but I want us to feel the vulnerability in this story. And I think that's important. Let's take the story for a moment of Peter walking on water. Almost walking on water. There are lots of ways to imagine what motivates Peter in that moment in the story, okay? The one I'm going to suggest might sound a little fanciful to you, but just stay with me for a minute. Given the vantage point from which we've been considering Peter's experience so far, it doesn't feel like a reach to me to think of him as following Jesus so that he can become part of the group that actually initiates the overthrow of the oppressive regime. He wants to be close to the Messiah because the Messiah is going to deal with the oppression. Who doesn't want to deal with oppression? Especially if you're oppressed. And there's something about this leader that says to Peter, this is the guy. This is the guy who's going to put the cell together that's going to act and deal with the Romans. That's going to deal with our oppression. And I want to be in for that. I want to be at the front of that. So, if that's what's going on in his head, he's following the guy who's going to lead the revolt. He's following the guy in his imagination who's going to overthrow the oppressors by force, because that's the language of that narrative. And he is in training to be a fighter. He's already inclined to action by personality, and now he has the leader that's making the right claims. And in this moment of story, he has somebody that apparently is like G.I. Joe on divine steroids. I mean, this guy does stuff that, like, could you imagine a whole army of these guys? You got to remember, the disciples are out on the lake in this little boat, rowing to save their ass, and they're not having really good luck. And what did they just come from? They just came from Jesus feeding like 5,000 plus people with some kids' lunch, right? So they got this Uber leader. They got this guy who's doing all this crazy stuff, who could just summon resources out of some kid's back pocket. And now they're out there in this storm, and they're ready to go down, and he comes walking to them on the water. Like, if he could train us how to do this stuff, how long are the Romans going to last? If there's 20 of us and we could all do this stuff, how long would the Romans last? Can you get inside Peter's head? Jesus is on the water, and he's walking on it, and he's their leader, and he's the one who's training them, and he said, Peter says, I want to do this too, and Jesus says, okay, get out of the boat. You can do it. You could be G.I. Joe on divine steroids too. Super soldiers of Jesus do things like walk on water, get out of the boat, man. And he gets out of the boat, and he's doing it. And then he starts to sink. I love that he starts to sink, because if he kept walking on the water, this story just stopped being for me. I'm like, just stop being for us ordinary people. But he doesn't. He goes down. Oh. If Peter gets turned by Jesus, it's moments like this that give us a bit of a glimpse into what Jesus turns him toward. What Jesus radicalizes him toward. He wants to be radicalized. And he's chosen Jesus, and Jesus has chosen him. But Jesus tells Peter, after he fishes him out of the drink, that his failure to keep walking on water is a matter of faith. It's as if he's trying to help Peter correct his narrative. He wants to keep his personality and his orientation, this stuff about the self, intact. But he wants to turn it in a really unexpected, and I would say really unlikely, direction. It's a pretty profound mentoring moment. I don't know if you have anything in your story where you would say, I was rescued by someone. Or if you think of a moment where you feel like somebody said something to you that just, when you look back in your story, you can see that wasn't a 2-degree shift, that was a 20-degree shift. Like, something profound happened right there. This is that kind of a moment in Peter's life. He's going down. He's not going to be a super soldier if it means walking on water. And he's going to die to boot. And Jesus grabs him and pulls him out of the lake and saves him, which is what he asked for. Lord, save me, is the way we have the text. And then he says, and he could have said anything, right? Jesus could have said anything to Peter at that point. In terms of radicalizing someone, he's got Peter right in the moment. And what he says to him is, why did you doubt me? Not why can't you be Superman. Not why can't you be an uber soldier of the revolution. What happened to your trust just then? And what he calls Peter into in that vulnerable moment is into a deeper relationship with his mentor. There's a simple formula for training people that says, watch what I do. I'll do it with you. Then I'll watch you do it, and then you do it without me. And it's like Jesus is saying, if you want to be all in, for right now, just keep watching what I do. You're not ready yet. I would imagine that for someone like Peter, that was a bit of a shattering experience, happening as it does in front of everyone. And yet, Jesus doesn't shame Peter, which would have been a classic lever to use. He doesn't shame him, he just picks him up and sets him back on the way. And so later in the story, when Jesus asks his followers who they think he is, it's Peter that says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. That gives the right answer, if you will. And Jesus, as Matthew tells the story, Peter rather, as Matthew tells the story, is told by Jesus at this point in the story that he, Peter, is the one that Jesus will build the kingdom he has come to lead upon. So now stay in the story for a sec. Let's see what happens. Peter, in that moment, which is also public, happens in front of the disciples, and Jesus says that to Peter, you're the guy. Quite the promotion inside the cell. You're my right-hand man, Peter. You're right next to whatever kind of Messiah I am. Shortly after he gets that kind of public promotion from the movement's leader, Jesus says something about the narrative that Peter thinks is totally out of whack. He says, I got to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer at the hands of the religious leaders, I'm going to be tortured, I'm going to be killed. I'm going to rise again, but all this stuff's going to happen. And Peter gets in his face and says, no, you're not. No, you're not. Oops, loss of perspective. Somehow, the narrative in Peter's head that says, I am becoming this super significant revolutionary, and I have got a voice in this thing, is still running out of his old narrative. Which is why he can't accept the narrative that Jesus is speaking. It's like, no. You can't go to Jerusalem. And he says this to him. You can't go to Jerusalem. You can't suffer at the hands of the religious leaders. You can't get tortured and killed. Well, why not? Because that's not how the story goes. Well, which story? Your story or my story, Peter? Which narrative? The one you arrived with? Or the one you came to me to learn? Which one? This is the story where Peter, where Jesus says, get thee behind me, Satan, in the King James, right? To Peter, or to what Peter's saying, however you want to parse the text. He gets on him. Man. He gets right back on him and just says, no. Your inability, Peter, to entertain this narrative of radicalization, your inability to face into this, or your unwillingness, or your unreadiness, or whatever's going on here, that is the lie. That is the thing that needs to be undone for you to be radicalized in the way of Jesus. What narrative is that again? Right, the narrative of force, the narrative of violence, the narrative of meeting visible oppressive might with visible oppressive might to make right. The narrative of evil means equaling good ends. And there's this struggle going on in Peter between the story that he carried into this experience of being radicalized and the story his leader is telling him. And the dissonance is unacceptable to him. Listen to this is Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of what Jesus says to Peter when he gets after him. Remember, again, all the disciples is everybody. Anyone who intends to come with me has to let me lead. You're not in the driver's seat. I am. Don't run from suffering. Embrace it. Follow me and I'll show you how. Self-help is no help at all. Self-sacrifice is the way, my way, to finding yourself, your true self. What kind of deal is it to get everything you want but lose yourself? What could you ever trade your soul for? New narrative. Follow me and I'll show you how is being driven home. Old narratives are really hard to shake loose. Had a great conversation with somebody this week about this. We didn't use that language, but that's what we were talking about. Man, old narratives are hard to shake loose. They just get their tentacles in everywhere, right? That's why we can live from them, because they get embedded into all of our life. They kind of weave their way into everything. That's why they work. But when they stop working, or when we become open for whatever reason to their adjustment, to their revision, to their revitalization, to their radicalization, if you wish, that's the level of work we're in for. That's what's going on here. This story just has its tentacles in everywhere, and to get its tentacles out of everywhere is, wow. It's hard. Peter, as we keep going in the story, Peter has to go through Jesus putting someone's ear back on that he lopped partway off when the soldiers come to arrest him. He has to go through facing the fact that when it comes to action, he cuts and runs instead of staying to fight or do whatever he's supposed to do. He just leaves. Can't face his fear. He runs away. And when he finally does come back to the scene of the revolution, it's only to deny that he's a part of it anyway. He has to live through all that stuff to shake his story loose enough that it's open to change. And after Peter witnesses his leader's death and is early on the scene of his resurrection, he still hasn't shaken himself loose of the story that made him open to following Jesus in the first place. And you could say that even then, from the vantage point of Jesus, he has not yet been radicalized. And we know that from the story, because what he does is he goes back to the life that matches his old narrative. He goes back to fishing. He goes back to the world the way that it was. Because clearly, he jumped ship for the wrong guy. It didn't work. What didn't work? The old narrative didn't work. The one that says this is the guy that's going to form the terrorist cell that's going to blow away the Romans. Didn't happen. Better go fishing. I can only imagine what's going on in Peter's head and in his heart, because as a terrorist, he's kind of been a bust. Not least of all because he kept getting stopped by his leader and mentor whenever he tilted toward the kind of action that he thought he'd been recruited for, right? I mean, it's really been a catastrophic failure. My dad says that he doesn't go fishing to catch fish. He goes fishing so he can sit in the boat and think. Good, because, you know, sometimes the fish don't show up. I think maybe that's Peter, right? Maybe that's what's going on at this point in the story. He just needs to go sit in the boat and have something around him that feels like what he knew so he can just think a little bit and just try to figure this out. And maybe he's mulling the words that Jesus used when he rebuked him and told him that the radical way of Jesus was one of embracing suffering, of trusting God rather than self-help, of losing yourself to find yourself rather than becoming a super soldier in the army of God. Maybe all those teachings that Jesus witnessed after the rebuke, because if you read Matthew, if you read the story after Jesus gets in Peter's face, Jesus goes on to teach about things like simplicity, about caring with tenderness for the least of these, as illustrated by little children who are the most vulnerable children, people in the culture, non-people really in the culture. He goes on to teach about reconciliation, about forgiveness, about this curious key to access to the kingdom of God, which is the first being last. And Peter has sat through all of those experiences. After having Jesus say to him, that narrative you're running, that doesn't work. Maybe that's what's churning in his head, I don't know. Maybe it's in the boat, facing his own failure to understand the kind of radicalization Jesus was on about, that Peter begins to be turned, that he begins to be radicalized into the way of Jesus. Maybe that's where it starts to happen. Maybe this is where he begins to get radicalized into a revolution that is so completely contrary to his narratives of power and military might, so much about choosing to restrain those things in the service of others and in the service of love, that it required something as wild and crazy as a death and a resurrection to make the narrative palatable at all, believable at all. Peter goes on to lead the revolution that brought us here this morning. He does go on to be the cornerstone of the church that has become Christendom. He gets radicalized somewhere in this process into something that is so lovely and so good and so right that it is distressing to anyone that is on a different path than that. It is extreme to anyone that is not on that path. It's not usual. It's not traditional. It is radical. He gets radicalized into a way of life that looks like love, not violence. It looks like embracing, not rejecting. It looks like self-donation, not self-protection. It looks like healing rather than harming. And in the end, what it looks like is a movement that depends on the power of love to bring life. The power of restrained force. Peter turns out to be the one that leads the charge when it comes to helping people understand that this is not a story that's exclusive for the Jews, but that it's for everyone. And not just every race, but also every station in life. Peter is the one that early in the story champions care for the poor. Peter is the one that oral tradition tells us is martyred for his faith, at which point he asks to be crucified upside down because he's not. He doesn't want to be mistaken for his mentor. How about that? That's a different guy that stepped out of the boat, Peter. That's a different guy than the guy that wanted that power. That guy got turned. That guy got radicalized. That's crazy. That's crazy. Maybe there can be such a thing as good radical religious belief, but only if it looks like love. But that other narrative, that one that says we can take this into our hands and by might make it happen, that's a hard narrative to shake. That's a hard narrative to shake. I want to leave us with something that might feel like it's barely connected to this. You'll have to pay attention. I think the connection is actually really deep to what I've been talking about. It is for me, at any rate, and if it doesn't work that way for you, I apologize for the waste of your time. But I want us to watch a musician who's chosen what on the surface appears to be a very simple form do something extremely powerful. And I want you to pay attention, if you're able along the way as well, to the words that she sings. Because they are the most artful working of the most pivotal biblical text about love that I have ever heard in my life. They come to us, ironically, I believe, in this instance, courtesy of the White House.